Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Glenn Dahl. Glenn is the founder of Apex North Business Coaching, where he and his team leverage all of the lessons he learned throughout his fascinating career in order to guide leaders through the challenges that they face running their organizations so they can make the most of all of their opportunities. Glenn's career started out on the assembly line with Ford Motor Company building Ford Broncos. From there, he moved on to several sales and sales leadership roles before culminating as the CEO of Insignia Systems, where he led a significant turnaround effort, including an increase in shareholder value of 74% per share. Glenn has many fantastic takeaways from his business career, his research, and the partnerships he's developed along the way that he shares with his clients and his network, and I'm so happy to share them with you all today. Thank you all so much for being here for another episode. This conversation is going to jump into many great ideas and topics, including what is the CEO doom loop and how does Glenn work to help business leaders work through it to the other side? Why is it that people at all levels of the organizations tend to fall back on their competencies during stressful times? Glenn's also going to talk about the power of communicating more, why sharing more information and being more transparent actually solves more problems and rarely manifests the fears that stop most people from typically going this route. And he's also going to talk about the power of saying no, among many, many, many other interesting stories and topics that we're going to dive into that I'm so excited to share with you all today. Once again, thank you for being here for another episode. Please, before you go, like it, share it, subscribe to the show. And of course, we've got to quickly thank our sponsors. As always, HumanTel. If you haven't already, head over to HumanTel.com and enter the code INCOASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training to learn what people are likely thinking and feeling when you see shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers, you can head over to certifiedinterviewer.com to get all your questions answered about both the International Association of Interviewers and the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And while you're online, you can head over to inquasive.com to learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, and HR teams in order to teach them how to obtain the everyday confessions lurking in all of their high-value conversations. We really appreciate you being here week after week. Thank you so much. So now, without further ado, I introduce to you Glenn Dahl. Glenn, it is so great to see you. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today. How are you?
I'm doing really well, Michael. Thank you. It's great to see you again. It's a couple times we've got to chat now, and I enjoy every one.
I do as well. I really appreciate everything that you've shared, all of our conversations, and now we get to share it with everybody else. I've been asking to die you, let me try to say this. I was asking slash dying to ask you a bunch of questions. Watch me learn how to try to speak English in the middle of a recorded conversation. Been dying to ask you a whole bunch of questions since our conversation started. But the first question I'd like to ask you is about something that I know you focus on and do a lot of work with your leadership clients. And that is helping people get out of the doom loop.
The CEO doom loop.
Now, that doom loop could mean many things to many people. So let's kick this off here. From your perspective, what is the CEO doom loop? And then how do you work with people in order for them to get themselves through it to the other side?
Perfect. Great question. And I know the CEO doom loop very well, not only because did we interview 72 different CEOs and do an analysis on all those we interviewed them. We did the analysis on those interviews, and that's where we really saw the doom loop emerge, the concept of it. But once I started exploring that and comparing it to real-world examples that I work with my clients, I really had these flashback moments of myself as a CEO, and it resonated perfectly. And I'll tell you a quick story regarding the CEO playbook. So I've got a hard copy here. I've got PDFs people can download. And I gave one to a CEO. This guy runs like $200 million company. Pretty big company, right? He started off entrepreneurial. He's grown it. I mean, great company, great model. And I gave him a copy. And this was months ago. I know this guy. I met him a couple times. I was introduced to him. And he called me in January. And in January, say, you know, picked up. How you doing? He's Glenn. I got two questions for you. He goes, number one is, how did you know me so well to write a book about me? I just now read the CEO playbook. He goes, dude, thank you for writing a book at Mombi, and thank you for not telling anyone it was about me. And he just went on. He said, he's got everything in that book. Every single page is an issue I've either gone through or I'm going through now as a CEO. And so we had that conversation, and going back to the doom loop and myself and the search, I was a CEO and I was oftentimes in that doom loop. And what it really is, it's when as a CEO, the CEO, their job is they're the head of the company. However, many times the CEO gets there through a certain path and has competencies. A lot of times they could be an entrepreneur that started off, you know, like a construction company that the guy started as a carpenter with just him and his pickup truck, right? And he's built this business. He's been successful, hires people, grows and gets successful. And then what happens is something, there's, you know, some headwinds, economic issues, things don't go as well. And what do the people generally do when that happens? Well, you know, as human beings, if you know much about our limbic brain, right, we have this fight or flight mechanism, you know, in the base of our brain, and we regress into that, right, when we start getting a little fearful, a little panicked. And I see this right now with many CEOs and owners as it relates to recession, tariff, is a, okay, well, they start getting a little entrenched, a little fearful. They regress from being a leader and working on the business and leading the business, and they regress to going back to working in the business. So in my instance, when that happened to me, I would revert back to being to my sales background. All right, well, I'm gonna dig in and I'm gonna fix these things. I'm gonna help these people. And I would start interfering with my sales leadership. And this is the equivalent of knocking someone aside and saying, here, let me do it because you don't know what you're doing, right? And so this is making sense. Like, so you get to this level and then things start getting tough and then you panic and you regress back into the business and then you start interfering with your leadership. Instead of leading them and helping them, holding them accountable to achieving the goals and pointing the way, we're going to get there. I know we are, and having the confidence to lead, CEOs can regress back and get into these counterproductive measures. And the more they do that, the more, frankly, they piss off. If they've been able to hire smart people as leaders, they're going to start pissing them off. And then those people, what are they going to do? They're not going to stick around, right? And in, as this kind of doom loop keeps going, then the CEO is really unable to really attract good leaders to work on their team because no one wants to work for someone who is not a great leader. That's the doom loop.
And it's very relatable. And a couple of thoughts there. One, in how your client called you and said, how did you write a book about me? That very clearly, for those who aren't listening, that wasn't about him. That was the general book. It just correct. Related so well to yes. him. And I'm sure you see this from your CEO experience, from all the work that you do, that there is, and it's true for humans in general, but especially as you start looking at roles within businesses, that there is a nearly universal set of experiences that people go through. And it might be a little bit different in one industry than the other, or one size company than the other, or one personality than the other, but they all fit into the same buckets. At sometime we're going to go through the same cycle, so to speak.
Yes.
So, yeah. Even as we're trying to connect with people, one of the great ways to connect with people and to get them to open up is to do what you did with that playbook, which is communicate with them in a way so they feel like, oh, you understand. Not by telling me that you understand, but by illustrating in a way that demonstrates that you know what I'm going through without sitting in front of me like my judgmental father and telling me that you know everything that I'm going through.
Right.
So that was a great call out there. And then your point about regressing back to our competencies. Yeah. Under stress, we go to what we know. As soon as that limbic system, you called it out, flares out, as soon as we feel like the stress level, that panic kicks in, what do I feel most comfortable with? Well, if I came up in sales, that's what I do. If I came up as an engineer, that's what I do. If I came up in operations, that's what I do. And then now you're paying two people to do the same job and nobody to run the company because now we're both in sales or we're both in ops, or we're both in engineering or whatever it is.
Yep.
So I'm curious, as the leaders you work with read your playbook and as they work with you after, where are some of the early pivots that you see them start to make as they recognize, oh, maybe I have fallen into this doom loop a little bit. So here are the early changes I want to make to start working my way to the other side.
Yeah, great, great question. And this is something I definitely work with my CEO clients on in our one-on-ones. And now the fact that we have this touchstone of the CEO doom loop, and I know you're familiar with this concept, it's less about, oh, I'm a failure as a CEO, but more so, Glenn, I'm starting to feel like I'm getting into the doom loop. So we're putting it on this third party object. And then we have this common nomenclature that we can talk about it with, right? And I know, okay, now I know what you mean. Okay, well, let's talk to me about that. How are you feeling? Well, I'm kind of worried about the whatever. Sales are soft, this, that. I don't know if I can trust. I don't know if this is, I have the right person on my team. So we can start talking about the issue itself in more of a displaced manner versus like, hey, I feel like I'm a loser. Because one of the things that did come out, and this is kind of a hallmark of the doom loop, is that CEOs, and there were two CEOs out of 72 that use this exact quote. When we get into this conversation, we ask some early on questions and start getting deeper and deeper. It's like, well, what are your panics? Like, what do you think about when you wake up in a cold sweat at 3 a.m., which I did as a CEO? Like, what's on your mind? And it's really those things where I've heard it, again, two quotes where CEOs have said, I'm afraid that it's all going to go into shit and I'm going to be a failure. They don't say that the business fails. It's very personal that I'm going to be a failure. And it's that's that ego, right? That's that I'm a failure because my business failed. So then it's understanding that when a CEO says to me, I feel I'm getting into the doom loop, it's being able to separate those issues from them as a person and then start working on the issues.
That is enormous. By being able to say, I feel like I'm slipping into the doom loop, you're right. Now we're able to label what it is. And now we have a common adversary. So So everything you said is right. But to even double or triple down on that, now we have something we can work on together. Cool. This is what it is. Let's attack it. Let's come up with a plan. Now we have something in common we can work at shoulder to shoulder to go after. It's beautiful. The second one you illustrated, which I don't know if people realize how important this is separating the person from the issue to help them protect their self-image.
Yes.
Because when we are overcome by fear, that fear rewires our brain. So if I'm locked into, I don't want to be a failure, I don't want to be a failure, I don't want to be a failure, I'm literally not capable of opening my eyes to outside ideas, recommendations, solutions, because I'm so myopically focused on not being a failure. So now by being able to take that away, so now I'm not tying myself to it. And we could probably talk for an hour plus about how leaders at any level of the organization tie their self-image to their business when from many healthy perspectives, they should remain two completely separate things.
Correct.
But now we're able to help them protect their self-image so they can problem solve better. They can accept outside ideas, solutions better. They're now not going to feel that weight of failure. So they're maybe more willing to be a little bit more vulnerable, take risk on top. Because I'm assuming there's no way out of the doom loop without taking extra risk somewhere. We're going to have to figure out where it is and what makes sense. So now they're open to that. So by giving them something to label that we can attack together, by helping them save face and protect their self-image, taking it off their shoulder, and then giving them a light at the end of the tunnel, that alone makes using the doom loop concept so powerful. And that's something that we can honestly employ in conversations with our team, with our family, with anybody. It doesn't have to be at the CEO level to give them something that they can label, that they can disassociate them from a little bit, and then accept that teamwork approach to help solve. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that disassociate. And it's when I first heard you speak and when we first met last fall, Michael, I still remember how greatly that resonated with me was your shame, Like people, we fear shame. And that really hit me because I hadn't heard anybody state it that frankly before, but I identified with that as well. And I identify with myself as a CEO and that sense of tying my identity to it. And I remember like thinking about, well, I have to drive this certain kind of car and my wife and I need to live in this certain kind of residence because I need to maintain this image of a CEO. I need to dress a certain way. I actually had the chairman of our board say, Glenn, you need to learn how to talk like a CEO, how to act like a CEO, and think like a CEO. And what he meant was that exterior kind of illusion of, well, I'm a CEO, and I always do this deep voice CEO, like, you know, and there's so much of that that's really BS and tied up in our ego. And I think to your point, then it gets in our way as we're tying our own personal self-worth and self-esteem to that role or our company.
All fantastic points. And to a degree, there's value in learning how to speak, act, and be emblematic of the role that you're in. But to your point, is it the false idols? Is it just a show? Is it a cover for the real skill? Now it's a problem. And then is it feeding into your ego and all those things? So there's certainly a double-sided sword there. But as you bring up that concept of shame, it's also important to consider the juxtaposition, not just of the shame that we all want to avoid, but how far away that is from how we're currently seeing ourselves. So for most people who become CEO or leader or head, or you're at the top, like, that's it, right? I made it. I'm in charge. I'm the CEO. I'm the man. I'm the woman. I'm in charge. I'm the one. So now, and I don't say this with sarcasm or to talk people down, but I'm at the top, right? I belong. I made it. I'm here. Mm-hmm. Now, shame is so far away from that, that the fall from I'm at the top, I made it, all the way down to I'm ashamed of decisions I made or didn't make or outcomes or whatever. That's what makes it even harder in that situation because their egos are tied to it. So taking 100%. Them away from that, when I work with groups similar to the group that we met in, one of the things that gets all of my red flags up is when I hear people processing issues. They're like, well, how do I deal with this executive in my business? Or how do I deal with this board member? And I'm summarizing for effect, but the advice that the group gives them is basically, well, tell them that they're wrong, show them why they're wrong, make sure they understand that they're wrong, and then tell them the right way to do it. And I'm looking for air breaks, like, whoa, wait, hang on. No. All you're doing is violating their self-image to such a degree that we're going to make the problem worse. So your point about using the doom loop as a way to disassociate themselves and start focusing on solving the problem is a fantastic alternative.
Yeah. 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 And I think that's going at your earlier point is having the disassociate and then, let's work on the issues and then putting yourself as a CEO off to the side. What is the best way that you can work through this issue? And then that's where I get to that second level of communication that I heard when you spoke was really resonated is, look, you're not just trying to make yourself look good as a CEO. Like, that's not the point here. The point is for you to run an effective business, right? And for you to ultimately be successful, especially if you're tying your success to that business to be successful, is you need to be a really good leader. You need to make really good decisions. You need to have really good information. So it does, right? And that was the second part of many things that you said that hit me, but it's like, you just want to get, the truth. And so therefore pulling this kind of power play card of, I'm the smartest guy in the room or the smartest woman in the room because I'm the boss. Let me tell you what you need to do, or let me tell you how this should go, is like totally counterproductive. It should be, hey, I hired you because you're really smart. Let me ask you some questions, like put you at ease, like appeal to you, your ego and your intelligence. Don't get you regressed in your limbic brain, but get you thinking with your frontal cortex. Like, okay, let's get a play here. Like, what's the issue? What, you know, where are you stuck? How can I help you? What can we do? We're facing these issues as a business. I'm telling you, I'm leading us to a better place. We're going to get through some rough patches. We're in one. You know, what ideas do you have to help us get through this? Versus coming back and say, all right, I'm going to sit in on every single sales call going forward, which was like this guy. And I've heard it from other CEOs too since then.
Yeah, let me add more stress to your already stressful conversations by spying on them, and somehow that's going to help.
Michael, I still remember, I'm not going to say who the client was and then the team who was with me, remember, but they're like, you know, Glenn, we want you to come along. It's a big pitch, big potential client. And, you know, we rehearsed it and I had my little bit at the beginning, talk about the vision and the culture and company a little bit. And dude, I talked for 20 minutes and I still remember like my team was pissed. Like, why you took everybody, you said everybody's part. Why did you do that? And it's like, I probably thought I was, because I could deliver it the best. I don't know. Yeah, so many times I could push the rewind button, especially knowing what I know now. I didn't know it, Mike. When I was a CEO, I didn't have a coach. It was my first time in the role. And there were so many things that I just thought this is what I was supposed to be doing. I thought I was supposed to be the smartest person in the room. Thought I was supposed to be that person at the top of the organization. And I didn't know.
And what's several beautiful things that you just said is one, well, I get layers of it. Thank you for sharing the I took 20 minutes when I was supposed to have two, because that's something many leaders are guilty of. But so even acknowledging it, but acknowledging it with humor, right? Yeah, I jacked that up. But even that point of I didn't know better now, and I know years have gone past, but you use that as the example because you just shared it. But now you have a learning anchor. Like by being willing to listen to your team when they say, why did you do that? You jacked that up. One, you're multiple steps ahead of a lot of leaders at that point, because there are many that wouldn't have a climate where people felt it was okay to say that.
Yeah.
And two, if their people did say that, it would be, you go sit over there because I'm in charge and I'll take as much time in front of any room as I want because I sit in this desk, you sit in that desk. So go back to that desk. So credit there. But now there's a learning anchor. And I'm sure you hear this a lot too, where people will come up after a meeting and they'll say, man, thank you so much. I wish I knew this back at this time, or I wish I knew this before that conversation, or I wish I knew this before this happened. And yeah, that'd be great. But now you're actually ahead of the game, because we all make mistakes.
Yeah.
And you are no doubt going to be in a similar situation again. No doubt. So now we have a literal learning anchor. So the next time we're in a similar situation, we can be like, oh, I wish I did it better before. Here is the after. Now I have an opportunity to do it better because I could reflect on a previous example. So even just sharing that right there, having the humility and being self-effacing enough to recognize it, being able to listen to your team and acknowledge it, but then being able to say, yeah, I wish I knew it then, but I know it now. And now I have the anchor to make sure that I'm better for it moving forward. That's a great place to be. And I can't say it's rare, but it's not super common to find people that get there.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. And I do, I mean, think back, you know, we had that to a degree, but I think it was my openness to it, because I thought you might touch on this before, you actually did in the concept, but that concept of especially, I think the higher a business person goes in the organization, probably in other organizations as well, but is the imposter effect.
Yeah.
And I know we've talked about this before, you're aware of this. For me to be, I have this image in my head of, like walking into the CEO, the corner office, right? And it's mine. And I'm just sitting there. And I like say to myself, what the F do I do now? Because inside, I'm a kid from the suburbs of Detroit who barely got through high school and went to work on an assembly line, literally. Right. And here I am now. And in the company I was promoted to run as a CEO was a publicly traded company. It's shareholders, you know, Wall Street. And I have this photo of me standing in front of the NASDAQ sign with my name and my title and the company logo in the background right in Times Square. And like, to your point, that, you know, that fall from, wow, but when I was brought in, it was really, the company was just in the toilet. It was circling the drain. And at that point in time, I didn't have anything to lose. I was only playing to win. I used to tell people, I heard this phrase from someone, it's hard to fall down when you're already on the floor, right? Yeah. But we did. I was able to help lead a team that got us to a very successful place. And it was at that point that in my head, the game switched from, I wasn't playing to win as much as I was playing not to lose. And that's a different game.
It is. And there's a couple of things I want to go back there and touch on with you. And we've had him on the show and I recommend him all the time. If people haven't listened to George Cole Reiser, I say Cole Reiser, it's Cole Reiser. So sorry for messing up your name again, George. And read his book, Care to Dare, which I can't recommend strongly enough. He talks about the difference between playing to win and playing not to lose. And when you see the way he writes it out and the way he compares it, and with your experience, you probably do this intuitively anyway, but then you can, within a few conversations or watching somebody in front of a room, you can start to see pretty quickly, like, are they playing to win or are they playing not to lose? And there's two different decision tracks. There's two different self-talk tracks. It leads to different results. Often when you're playing not to lose, you end up running into the thing that you were afraid of the whole time. So you end up, if not losing, trending in that direction as opposed to playing to win.
Yeah,
I would love to talk to you to learn more about that turnaround effort that you led, getting in at the ground level where things, you're already on the ground, you couldn't fall down. How do you build it back up? But before we do, you mentioned working on an assembly line.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm a hopeless romantic, but I feel like the assembly, for better or worse, and what people may or may not want to think about it or talk about it, in many ways, the assembly line, especially the automobile assembly line, plays a critical role in American history. What experiences did you take from working on the assembly line that still serve you today?
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things, Michael, that it's the lessons I learned were the things that I didn't want to do. So I worked at the Michigan truck plant. We made Ford Broncos. And the fact that everybody in that plant, their favorite thing about work was lunchtime, to drive to the liquor store to buy a fifth of vodka and consume it as quickly as possible before having to go back to work. It's really unfortunate. And I think that of working on assembly line, there's a bit of dehumanization in that.
Okay.
And there's a lack of purpose.
Mm-hmm.
A lack of respect for people's individuals' abilities and intelligence, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, in those, the heyday, I mean, those were really good paying jobs and very good benefits, and the people who worked there and such, they could get overtime hours. It was a good paycheck. But the soul sucking, as I saw it, to that, and the mentality of working within a union is something that doesn't personally appeal to me. I admire the protection they've given workers and the role they play in our history of the workforce. The aspect to me of the fact that based on how long I've been here, it doesn't matter how well I'm doing my job or how much more I want to learn or thrive and grow my job. I could get called a rate buster and told to slow down and just go, you know, this thing, and it doesn't matter because I'm not going to get paid anymore anyway or get advancement. Because everybody makes the same amount of money unless they survive longer.
Sure.
And for me then to come back as a CEO and now really work with a lot of entrepreneurial business owners and CEOs, the fact that what I really admire and like working with companies is companies that have a sense of purpose. They have a vision. They have culture. I think really great companies and the companies I like working with, the CEOs, are CEOs and owners who want to build a better company, that invest, that have a culture and invest in a culture. They have a vision. They have a purpose to do what they want to do. And they really believe that whatever industry they're in, they can do something better or unique to better serve their clients, make better lives for their employees, more productive, more happy, and for those people's families. And by doing that, they'll better serve themselves and their investors.
That's a really good, I know you used the word before, but I'm going to go back to it. All juxtaposition right. Between the just do your job mentality and the soul sucking part, like you said, versus the maybe meritocracy isn't the right word, but I have passion, I have purpose. And if I work really hard and do the best I can and add value, I'll be rewarded for it. And I don't just have to survive 15 years to get the next increase. So that's
right.
It's a very good point. And your comment about not recognizing people's individual intelligence I think was very important. It's not the perfect analogy, but not too long ago, I was working with a manufacturing company that doesn't have like the assembly line in the truest sense, but they have workers on the factory floor that basically just do one thing all day long. Like this is the piece of the thing that they manufacture. And when I first started working with them, there was a real disconnect between the managers and the people on the floor. And the people on the floor felt like they weren't recognized. And when I first started working with the management team, I don't want to say that they were disrespectful, but they almost like joked it off a little bit. And so I asked them, I said, let me ask you this. And I picked one piece of it. I said, who knows the most about how this machine works? The guy that runs it. Oh, you mean the guy that 8 to 10 hours a day just runs that one machine and does nothing else? And when it breaks or needs to be troubleshot, or if there's a problem with the material that has to be fixed on the fly, or if something else that was done earlier wasn't quite right, it needs to be fixed now. Who's the expert at doing that? Oh, the guy that runs that machine 8 to 10 hours a day. Yeah. So let's start treating everybody out there as an expert and watch how the culture changes. And within, I don't want to exaggerate, so let's call it 6 months. I'm getting phone calls that, now that we're treating them like with respect and like experts and we're asking their questions and getting their input, they do that one thing more than everybody else. Let's give them credit for that. So let's flash forward to your turnaround. Publicly traded company, you brought in, you're the CEO. Good news is you're already on the floor, so you can't fall down. Bad news is you got to build it back up. So kind of start with the same question, lessons you learned from the assembly line. I'm sure there are thousands of lessons that you learned from turning this organization around, good, bad, and indifferent. What are the lessons that stick with you the most from that process?
Where do I begin, Michael?
Anywhere you want.
Thanks. I think it's one is having a plan and a strategic direction. Now, strategy is a big word. But at that point in time, really the strategy was we need to save the company. The company, we were hemorrhaging money, cash, in business losses every quarter. And one of the things you need to do is get focused. And so what I really did, and again, this is gonna remember, like, and I was not trained to become a CEO. I had worked at a really good company before where I'd learned a lot about planning, but I really remember this really well. My early days that my CFO came in to my office and said, Glenn, I've got a call with an investor this afternoon and he wants, and I still remember pulling out a plain sheet of paper. I'm like, what is my plan? I didn't have one really. I had something intuitively of what we needed to do. And if I remember these 3 points, they're probably not exactly what it was, but it was pretty much as like, okay, first, number one, we're going to focus on our customers. Number two, we're going to focus on supporting the sales team because those are the people that are out front with our customers. And number three, we're then going to look internally to say anything that's not focused on one or two, we're not going to do it. And, you know, and that took, there's a whole lot of stuff that like just immediately cut that away because under caring about our customers is okay. That was driving sales because that's what really had fallen down. There's a lot of things we had to do in terms of internal cost cutting as well. But that goes back to number three. If we had roles or people that weren't really critical in supporting our customers, right? Customer service or the manufacturing of our product or ensuring our product was done well, or the salespeople, making sure the salespeople were spending as much time as they could out talking to potential customers, we said, we're going to do it. And that cut away a whole lot of clutter and got us very focused. I think this secondly was really finding that the previous CEO had been in that seat for, wow. What I really needed to do is establish myself as a leader, but also establish a new culture. And culture lives inside of people. And so what I really needed to do is begin going through and building my own team. And I had the opportunity to build my own team from some of the people who were already there, who said, great, you know, we really believe in this new person and what they want to do because they probably were kind of tired of seeing what had happened before where the company had slowly degraded and it was for a different competitive reason, but also bringing in some of my own people, right? People that I trusted and knew from my previous career, but also bringing in new people. And through that amalgamation of finding out, hey, here's the people who really believe in this vision and that I can lead and want to be part of this new team of taking this company from where it was into something new. And the name of the company was called, it was Insignia. And it's not the company that makes Best Buy's televisions either. We're much, much smaller. But what we did is we basically stuck a flag in the ground and said, look, this is Insignia 2.0. And it may sound trite or cheesy, but it was something that we really had again, if we talk about that common objectivity to say when I could ask someone, why are we doing things this way? Oh, because we've always done it that way. I could say, well, no, this is Insignia 2.0. So anything that we're doing just because we always do it, we're either going to cut it or we're going to reexamine it, right? So we weren't playing to lose anymore because I didn't care about losing that stuff. And it also, as a new CEO, I didn't have a personal identity tied to that. The previous CEO, you know, he might have had that, right? Because he built a lot of that. And I didn't. That wasn't my legacy. I'd come in from outside the company. So I'm like, well, that's probably a good reason why we need to not do it. What would we do under Insignia 2.0? So we started to play to win until we got successful. And then that's when in my head, I didn't, in really, we achieved that first strategy of turning the company around and getting it successful. We got successful. However, I needed to come up with the next strategic vision to really rally around to get to the next thing, rally myself and the team. And I couldn't grasp it. And that's where I faltered. And as I looked, then I didn't know. I started going into the doom loop, right? But when you're in the doom loop, it is so hard to see. And I was not wise enough, as many of my clients are, to hire a business coach. Or really, you know, to seek someone from the outside to really help me think through that and to hold me accountable and, you know, kind of tell me the things that my team might not tell me or my wife's not going to tell me, but I needed to be told. So, you know, unfortunately, the company got bought out. It was a publicly traded company, got taken over, and I was out of a job 8 months later.
Wow. Well, so, but that does mean, I guess, on the good side, that within 8 months, you did get it turned around and you did get it winning again. Oh. So,
no, well, the turnaround, yeah, that was years before that. Yeah. But it was really at a point that we got successful that we became a target for a takeover.
Okay. Oh, that's a very good point.
And we were a publicly traded company. So, yep. You know, fair enough. That's the way things work in business.
Unfortunately, when the beast starts to eat.
Yeah.
But much like with your doom loop, that's a great point with the 2.0. So with your Insignia 2.0, you're accomplishing a whole bunch of things, but two things right off the top. Number one, this is our new direction forward. We're playing to win. That flag in the sand, it could sound trite, but it's very important. So what's done is done, past is the past, we're moving forward. But it also gives you your response to the inevitable challenges. So serving two things at once, number one, here's where we're going. But number two, when somebody pushes back, it's the answer I need before I need it in order to keep us moving in the right direction. And with that, you also talked about focusing on your two things, customers and sales. And if it wasn't focused on that, we're not going to do it. Yeah. And you mentioned that what we weren't going to do a couple of times. And I feel like from the outside, looking into a lot of organizations, that focusing on what we're not going to do is equally, if not sometimes more important than focusing on what we are going to do. And that gets missed, especially when we're scrambling for new sales, we're scrambling for new opportunities. It's almost like we'll take whatever comes our way.
Right.
And I'm not going to argue that there's never a time and place where that's not the right thing. But if we're really looking for a strategic prolonged turnaround, then focusing on what not to do is at least as equally important.
Yes.
Is focusing on what to do. I imagine as you were working through your Insignia 2.0, that there was some pushback. People didn't necessarily like the idea, didn't like the new direction, be it for comfort because we always did it, or maybe like an outright disagreement, didn't want to get on board with new directions. You talked about building a culture that lives inside of people as well. I'm curious, what were some of the techniques that you used to help move people from that state of resistance? I know we're failing, but I don't want to change, to get them to buy into that Insignia 2.0.
Yeah, really good question. Thanks for that. I think one of the things was communicating more. I had observed the previous CEO who every quarter would do an earnings call with investors and then really take the same information and call. We have an employee town hall and really share kind of the same information. And when I was observing that in action, to me, it didn't seem to be resonating. You know, this is like case employees of a company and we had our own manufacturing operation within there. They're not the same audience as savvy investors of a publicly traded company, right? And so the one of the things I started doing is in that town hall meeting, I think I actually sped it up and started meeting every month and really started sharing a lot more. And that even evolved from doing those larger town halls then to doing smaller lunches. Like we had a lunchroom and I would sit in a chair and sit way back from me like, all right, what questions do you have for me? You know, what do you want to ask? And just really have these conversations. And the more I did that, the better the communication spread, the better the message got, the more that people believed in where we were going and what we were doing. And then also another thing that it really had to change out some of the people on the team. And these it's always tough. No one likes to talk about firing people or getting fired, but there were frankly people in the company who were actively resistant to the change and did not go along and their performance suffered. And so really we had to cut ties with some people. And the while it's unfortunate, especially for them, what I gained was the respect from a lot of the other employees that said, okay, he's saying this, but he's taking action. And so I was really trying to live what I was saying as it relates to the change and to do things differently.
And that's by taking action. I mean, people say walking the talk or however they say it.
Right.
But really what you're doing is you're giving people evidence. Like it's one thing to say, it's another thing for conversations to be had in a boardroom or in a manager's meeting or on a whiteboard. But what, 90 to 95% of the employee base, if not 98% of the employee base, they're never going to see those conversations.
Right.
So and they might see the results, they might not. And if they do, they might not even realize it. So to walk the walk, so to speak, but what you're really doing is you're giving people evidence. We are committed. This is what we will do. This is what we won't do. And in case you were questioning it, here's your proof. And that proof breeds trust, and the trust breeds the commitment and the action that goes with it. So that was, on one hand, it is unfortunately true that sometimes it's addition by subtraction. And if we're committed to a new direction, hey, maybe they're right. Maybe this won't work, but there's only one way to find out. We're going to be fully committed to get there. And if you're not on board, there's other places that you can go find work. I apologize. Right. Actually, I don't even apologize. You can go. You had your opportunity. but though communicating more. I feel like for people, especially leaders, and especially leaders in challenging situations, there's a fear of communication because I'm going to ask questions that I might not have the answer to or I don't want to answer. And I don't want people to think it's bad because I don't want them to leave and I don't want to hurt morale and I don't want to. Right. And yes, those are valid concerns. Yet time and time again, the more we communicate with people, and the more transparent we are and the less they feel like anything is being hidden from them, the more commitment and the more buy-in and the more appreciation that we get. And for you to even take that a step further and frame the message around the audience. So it's not just the same thing the investors are getting. Here it is packaged for this particular audience to grasp it, to understand it, and then to personalize it, the smaller meetings, not just the big calls, meeting them in the lunchroom, allowing them to control the conversation. Those steps might seem like little things, but for the ability to resonate and build trust with the audience, they were all huge and very important steps. So well done. Those little things all add up and they all matter.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, what I think about now is when I'm working with the CEOs I work with is the power of questions. And that's something I wish I was better at then. I really thought that the communication was me presenting the vision and talking. And well, I think if I go back to what we just talked about, those lunchroom conversations was answering questions. I think that's the real power is in not only answering, allowing people to ask questions and answering them, but as leaders asking more questions then. And really that said, you know, this guy on the factory floor who ran the machine, he's the expert. Why, just because someone's the boss, does that make them the expert? I'm going to tell them what to do, versus the truly smart people at the top. They're like, hey, I don't know your job. I can't tell you your job. Tell me about it. How could your job be better? How can I help you in the job? And really soliciting as much as that feedback as possible and the collective intelligence that we have in our any given employee base. And then as leaders saying, okay, here's the direction we're going. Here's what we're going to take from that to go this direction. And I think that's then the power of saying no. Because everybody's going to have ideas, but as a leader, we need to say, all right, well, given the direction we're headed, which I'm very confident about, we're going to get there. Here's what we need to do that. And I remember observing it earlier in my career and really understanding and believing it now is usually it's the smartest people that talk less, and they usually talk last.
I couldn't agree more. And not only the smartest, but I would say oftentimes the most confident.
Yeah.
They have the least to say. When they do, yeah, it's typically more impactful. It's typically more on point. It might come more from questions and less from statements. Yes. And I do agree with last. Let's give everybody else a chance. And then what I've seen too is I'm going to give everybody else a chance. I'll speak last. And if somebody has a good point and it was going to be my point, I'm going to let them own it. Yeah. I don't have to say that's where I was going. That's what I was going to say. That was my idea. Good job. You're right. That's where we were going to go. No, it's just good point. Let's do that. Great thought. Get after it. Like it's letting them own it and not feeling that need to come back and say, you know what? You're really smart, but I'm just as smart because I had that idea too. I was just nice enough to let you say it before I did. So that's a tremendous point. As a matter of fact, that's such a tremendous point. Let's go out on that because that is awesome. And that's a great place to leave folks. So let me ask you this. We've talked a lot about your playbook, helping people get out of the doom loop, the way people can connect with you and work with you. So for people who have listened to this and they're saying, Glenn sounds awesome, I want to work with Glenn and learn more from his experience, where can they connect with you and how do they reach out to you?
Well, we're on the good old trusted internet, apexnorthcoaching.com. And my email is pretty simple. It's Glenn Dahl, G-L-E-N-D-A-L-L, at apexnorthcoaching.com. And would love to hear from anybody who might listen to your podcast, Michael. I know you've built up quite an audience, done a lot of these. And I really appreciate the opportunity to come on and have this chat with you. It's great.
I appreciate the conversation. I've enjoyed every single time we've had the chance to talk. Today is no exception. I've been taking notes while you've been talking. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing some of your experience and expertise today. Thank you. I'll make sure to include the links in the show notes. And I won't include your playbook in the show notes, but I will include the link where people can go to download it. So if they want it, they can have almost direct access to it without having to go searching for it. So, but I can't thank you enough. Thank you very much for taking the time. I appreciate you sharing everything.
Thank you.
And I can't wait till our next conversation.
All right, Michael, that sounds amazing. Take care. A good rest.
Take care. We'll talk to you soon. Bye. Glenn, thank you so much for a great conversation. It's always great to connect with you. I appreciate everything that you took the time to share today. You said something towards the end of the conversation that really jumped out, and I wish we had a whole nother hour just to unpack. The smartest people typically talk the least, and they often talk last. A very powerful and very true statement, and I am thrilled that you worked that into the conversation. Thank you. I also love all of the thoughts that you shared about how we can work to get out of our own negative mental space and how we can avoid trying to get out of the hole by making the hole deeper. It's like being in a Jeep stuck in the mud. The more you spin the tires, the deeper the hole gets. All too often, we find ourselves in a situation where we're spinning those tires and we feel like it's helping, but it's really not. And thank you for walking us through how we can recognize that and how we can work with ourselves and our business partners in order to get through it. I truly appreciate everything you shared today, Glenn. Thank you. And thank you all for taking the time to join us for another great conversation. We appreciate you being here week after week. So supporting the show. Hopefully you're taking notes along the way and taking the lessons that you learned back to your organization, your family, your customers, and beyond. Thank you for being here. Again, please, while you're here, take a quick second, like the show, share the show, subscribe to it, share us your feedback. What would you like to hear more or less of? We would love to hear it. Thank you for being here. And make sure you check out our sponsors. Again, Humatel. For anyone who's thought about developing the skill set to recognize what people are likely thinking and feeling by accurately interpreting shifts in their facial expressions and body language, you got to head over to humatel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class online training. For the professional interviewers, those of you that are interested in the International Association of Interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn not only what you can get from, but also what you can contribute to the International Association of Interviewers. And that's also where you'll get your questions answered for the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. How do you qualify, prepare for, pass, and what can the designation mean for you in your career? And finally, while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, negotiators, HR teams, and more, in order to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to uncover hidden value in all of their high impact conversations. Once again, we appreciate y'all being here. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.